Okay, we're beginning here on the last line of Lamed Tet Amud Bet. The Gemara brings the Mishnah that says, Ones shote be'atzitzo. When it comes to anes, he has to drink from the cup that he chose. Equivalent of saying that he has to lay in the bed that he made, that if he rapes this woman, he has to marry her. Bal korcho, he has no choice in the matter. So amalei rova mi par zakai, the Ravashi. So rova mi par zakai says, Ravashi michtei, migmar gmirei mehadodi. They are learnt one from the other. There's zeres shovel between ones and mifateh. And therefore, what's true by one should be true by the other. So how dodi? So why don't we learn this issue as well? Why is it something that's unique to anes that he has to marry the woman against his will? We should say the same thing by mifateh, that he should have to marry her. Why are we saying over here that he has the right to make a choice or the right to decide whether he marries her or doesn't marry her? So Amar Kroa, he says, because the pasuk says mahor im harenu lo liisha, because the pasuk by mifateh says that we bring her quickly to be his wife. And again, here, mohar, and the connection between what mohar betulot is and the payment of the ketubah, which we've discussed earlier. But there it says, mari merenu lo lisha. Lo is midato. That is, on his own volition or from his acquiescing to marry this woman. But we cannot force this man to marry the woman. So Tosafot over here asks, well, don't we have the word lo? Also by me'anes. Over there it says, v'lo tiyeh li'isha, that she will be to him a wife. So why don't we darshan over there also, that lo means lo midato, that he also has a choice over there. So Tosuk gives one answer, which is, v'yesh lamar, de'ein zvoro shiyeh midato. It doesn't make any sense that he should have any choice in the matter. Kemen shim nasa, because once he marries her, it's clear there in the psukim, lo yuchal shalchal kol yamav. He's not a divorcer forever. So it's clear if he already marries her that he's stuck forever. So then it doesn't make sense that we should give him a choice up front to decide whether he does or does not marry her. It's clear that the inability to divorce the woman afterwards is all part of the result of his action. And therefore we have to say that he is compelled to marry this woman or to be together with this woman. And that's why we do not darshan that by the case of me'anes. The other answer that Tosfot gives is that va'od v'lo tiyeh kai aisha. That lo tiyeh isha is going about the woman, is not talking about there his right to choose the woman, but rather the woman's right to choose for herself whether she wants to get married. Over here, but mahor yimarenu lo liisha, clearly over here, the lo is a reference to him and not to her. And that's why we say over here it's lo midato versus the lo by me'anes, which is midata, but not midato. You could also argue, and it's similar along this vein or lines that Tosfot is suggesting over here, whether lo is said at the beginning of the phrase, where there, it's just giving us an introduction or telling us who the subject of the phrase is, rather than lo in the middle of any phrase, where there it's making a statement about lo midato. And so along the lines of Tosafot's explanation, just using the structure of the lo in the pasuk, to tell you that depending where it's placed in the pasuk, will tell you whether it means midato or simply indicating to us who the subject of the phrase is. Now the Gemara says, Ketzad shote batzitzo. I'm Rav Kahana. I'm Rita Lishmaita Kameid Rav Zvid Midnarda. I asked this, or I was speaking over this subject, this material before Rav Zvid Midnarda. And I said, Neiti Asay, Vinidche Lotase. Why don't we have the Asay come over here and override the Lotase? Now, as far as the Asay is concerned, we know the Asay is Veloti Elisha, that this man must marry the woman. So in the case of Me'anes, he is obligated, compelled to marry the woman. So there is a mitzvah Asay. What mitzvah lo tasei we are speaking about is not so clear. Rashi says that it's a case, Dein ru yalavo b'Yisrael kongom mamzeret. Rashi says the lav here is a lav of someone who's not allowed, because of yichus, to marry into klal Yisrael. And that's the lav, that's the lo tasei that we are speaking about over here. So the suggestion is, why don't we say, asei doche lo tasei? Therefore, there is an osei to marry this woman. A lo tasei not to marry a mamzeret. And therefore, it should be overridden. The assay should come along and override the lotase in this case. So we would invoke assay doche lotase, and despite the fact that he's not allowed to marry this woman, we should say here, in this instance, he's allowed to marry this woman. Now, Tosafot already raises a serious issue here, because we've already darshan v'lo tiyeh l'isha, isha haruya lo. We have a drosha that specifically states that the assay only applies when the woman is ruya lo. And if that's the case, then over here, it wouldn't seem that he's compelled to marry a woman, or that we would override, the assay would override the lotasay in this instance. So why is it that he's even asking the question of assay doche lotasay? It seems precluded from the beginning because the assay already embedded in it says he can't marry someone that's not to be uya lo. So Tosafot entertains different Lavin at first to see maybe that would be the suggestion. His final solution to the problem is actually to say that ain't Ochanami. That over here we're saying that it's Asay would not be Dochalot Asay. And the gist of the question of the Gemara is, why doesn't this become the paradigm to teach us in other places that Asay is not Dochalot Asay? Because in this instance, that's exactly what we're saying. We're saying despite the fact that there's an Asay, he can still only marry Sharu Yalo. The fact that the Torah does not invoke Asay Dochalot Asay shows you maybe that doesn't apply. And that's the question that's being asked by the Gemara. There are others that suggest to Velotiyeli Isha that Raka Isha Ruyalo is a derivative of the conclusion of the Gemara over here. And only through the Gemara over here do we come to that conclusion that when it says Lotiyeli Isha, that it's Isha Ruyalo, which is more like an Asmachta rather than a Limud. And Tosafot says, here we have a Havamina, but just like this individual will have to pay Knas when it comes to Mamzeret, that so too he will have to marry her in this case. And therefore we should invoke this principle of Asay Doche Lo Tasay, even if you say it has to be Isha Ruyalo, but if he has to pay Knas, in instances where he has to pay Knas, he should have to marry the woman. Okay, there are cases where he doesn't pay Knas, so in those cases it will not be an Isha Ruyah. Maybe the equation is when you pay Knas, that is called Isha Ruyalo. And we will invoke the din of Asay Dochalot Asay. So he's Amarli, Rav Zvid min Naharda responded to Rav Kahana and said, Heicha amrina nete Asay v'nidchelot Asay. When do we invoke the principle of Asay Dochalot Asay kigon mila bitzarat? That is like when mila overrides tzarat. Now as Tosafot points out, that is not so simple because Rabbeinu Tam says, L'simana ba'almanakte. The Gemara only brought this down as a simana. By the case of Mila, the fact that a child who has Tzarat on his Mila, and he goes to do the Mila, we're allowed to cut off the Tzarat, over there there's both an Asay and a Lotasay to cut off a Beheret. And nevertheless, we say that the mitzvah of Mila overrides. So there it's Asay Doche Asay Vilotasay. It's not your classic case of Asay Doche Lotasay. So the Gemara just brought it down as a siman that Asay is Doche Lotasay. But the classic case of Asay Dochalot Asay is Kilayim Bitzitzit. And that's what the Gemara really meant to say over here. This is not like your classic case of Asay Dochalot Asay that you find me Kilayim Bitzitzit. And Mila Bitzarat is just a way to indicate that there is this concept of Asay Dochalot Asay. Delo Efshar L'Kiyumei L'Asay. In a case where it's impossible to be Mikayim the Asay. Meaning that if you have, and this is an important principle that we've seen in the beginning of Yevamot with regards to Asay Dochalot Asay, is that generally we only invoke the principle of Asay Dochalot Asay where we have no option, where we have inability to accomplish both the Asay and the Lot Asay. But if in a case where we do have the option to create situations in which one will be okay and one will be in other situations, then we will never say Asay Dochalot Asay. Now here the Gemara uses it in a slightly more innovative way, which says that, when do we say Asay Dochalot Asay was impossible to Mikayim Nasei? Of Hocha, Iamra Delo Beina, Mital Asay Klau. Over here, when the woman says that, I don't want to get married, she can refuse the marriage, then the Asay drops away. So now, according to what Tosafot suggested before, that the question here is, why don't we use this as a paradigm to teach us that in all of the Torah, Asay is not Dochalot Asay? The Gemara here says it's not a real Asay. The Asay here is somewhat diminished. It doesn't have the power of a normal Asay, because over here, the Asay is not absolute. Not in every situation is he obligated or compelled to marry the woman, because the woman has a right of refusal. And her right of refusal actually diminishes the Asay, or in a sense, makes it that the Asay doesn't have so much power. The way Rashi describes it over here is that we're going to tell her, in situations where the Isha is not Ruiyah, we're going to tell her, or we're going to force her to say, I don't want to get married. And therefore we can eliminate the Asay, and there will not be a conflict between the Asay and the Lot Asay. Now from Rashi, it's not clear whether we would compel her or we ask her to do it. According to Rashi, it seems like we ask her to do it, and she would comply. If she doesn't comply, what do? That is subject to a machloket as to whether we compel her and we force her to go through with it, or in a case where she doesn't comply, maybe there would be an Asay Doche Lot Asay. That's the way Rashi explains it. Tosafot again, who says that the question here is whether this is a paradigm to teach us that Asay is not Dochalot Asay, says it's not a real Asay. And since it's not a real Asay, you can't learn from this as a paradigm to other cases of Asay Dochalot Asay. So according to Rashi, you can basically eliminate the Asay, so there's no conflict between the Asay and the Dochalot Asay. And the Ramban even says in Rashi Shita that Anan Sadeh, that women in these situations would not want to get married and violate the Lav, and therefore we say it's as if the Asay is gone. According to Tosafot, the many of the other Rishonim, we're talking about an assay that is somehow encumbered or diminished by the fact that the woman has a right of refusal over here. The Tosafot Yishanim over here on the Daf actually suggests that it's an interesting problem, which is that both the woman and the man are governed by the Lota say over here. If she's a mamzeret, not only is it restricted for him to marry her, there's always a restriction on her to marry him. And the assay of a Lota Yel Isha is only an assay on the man. So you could say assay dochalota, say with regards to the man vis-a-vis the woman. But for the woman vis-a-vis the man, she only has the Lota, say she does not have the assay. And his assay will not protect her and not allow her to go through with the assay dochalota assay. And that's what the ikuv means, that since the woman doesn't have an assay because she can refuse over here, and there's nothing compelling her to get married, therefore there's no assay dochalota assay for the woman, and that's the way that Tosfot Yishanim explains the Gemara. Now from this, Tosfot starts to investigate, when do we say that it's possible to accomplish a mitzvah assay in other manners? So for instance, when it comes to kilayim bitzitzit, over there, the reason that we allow kilayim bitzitzit is because techelet, the blue strings, have to be made out of tzemer, have to be made out of wool. So if I have a wool baget, that's not a problem. But if I have a pishtan baget, if I have a flax or linen baget, in that instance, I'm going to have to put tchelet, I'm going to have to put wool on the baget. So over there we say kilayim is mutar b'tzitzit. Tosfot says, why don't I just say that I don't have to violate it? The assay I can accomplish when I wear tzemer. So why should I be allowed to wear pishtan and violate the mitzvah of kilayim in order to wear tzitzit? Just don't wear pishtan, only wear tzemer. So Tosfot says that's not a reasonable request. You can't say to somebody, don't wear pishtan, only wear tzemer, because then you won't have a problem of assay dochalot assay. That's not a reasonable suggestion. Over here, where it's the woman making a choice whether she wants to get married or not get married, that's the case when we say the assay is not in full force, or that the assay can be somehow mitigated. On the other hand, when you're talking about making a choice, and now we take away a choice from some individual, that is not a fair assumption that the assay doesn't apply. Because over there, it's not an assay about the single object where it'll apply. It applies by this object, not by this object, that we don't say. That's not called efshar. If a person in the summertime wants to wear linen because it's cooler, can't tell them, oh, you have to wear tzemer, because otherwise you're going to be in violation of kilayim, and we're not going to invoke assay dochalot assay. So Tosfot says that that's not considered to be efshar, and therefore we will allow the assay to be dochalot assay. Okay, now we continue with the Mishnah. Itoma shinit arsa v'nit garsha. Over here, when you read the Mishnah, it's not clear how all of this works together. Because the Itoma can manifest itself in two ways. One is the Itoma is literally that she's an orphan. The other case of the Itoma is where her father already married her off and now she's divorced, so she's the Itoma b'chaye avia. So that's number one. Then it says shinit arsa v'nit garsha, that she got halachically engaged and divorced. Is that modifying Itoma, or is that another case in the Mishnah? All of this is somewhat unclear. The Gemara will clarify what it thinks the case is, but just reading these words, it's not clear how to put together this phrase of Yitoma Shinita Sarvinita Garsha. Rabbi Elazar Omer, Ha'ones Chayav Ve'mifateh Patur. In these cases where it's Yitoma Shinita Sarvinita Garsha, Rabbi Elazar says that if it's a case of Me'anes, he's Chayav to pay. It's a case of Mifateh, of seduction, he is Patur. Amar Rabba Barachana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Elazar B'shita Rabbi Kiva Rabbo Amra. Stam Rabbi Elazar in the Mishnah is Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. So Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, who is one of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yochanan is saying that Rabbi Elazar is saying this in the sheet of his Rabbi, Rabbi Akiva. Now, it's clear that he's not saying this in the sheet of Rabbi Yossi Aglili, who argues on Rabbi Akiva. The question is, which Rabbi Akiva is he saying this in? And what Rabbi Yochanan is coming to clarify is that this is Rabbi Akiva of the Mishnah. Rabbi Akiva of the Mishnah says that the knas of a girl, she'nit arsa v'nit garsha, belongs to her and not to her father. According to that, Rabbi Akiva, that's the statement of Rabbi Elazar Meir. The Amar Yesh La Knas Uknasa Le'atzma. In the case of Nitarsa V'Nit Garsha, there is Knas, and the Knas belongs to the girl herself. Mimai, how do you know that that's the case? Mitani Yitoma, because the Mishnah includes the word Yitoma. Rabbi Elazar Omer Haones Chayav VeMefateh Patur. If you were to take Yitoma standalone, Rabbi Elazar, if he says that Ahones is Chayav and Mifateh is Patur, Yitoma Pshito. What is even the question at hand? Yitoma clearly collects money for herself. She's the only party or vested party here. Her father no longer has anything to do with her because she's Yitoma. Either the father's not there, or because she's Yitoma B'Chaye Avia. In either of those instances, the Yitoma is on her own. Therefore, when it comes to the case of Ahones, when it's against her will, of course she's going to collect a ganas. And in the case of Mifateh, where she was seduced, and in the end she acquiesces to the overtures of the man, then there is no ganas because she gave in. She was mochel on the ganas over here. So it's obvious what Rabbi Elazar says, if you just told me yitoma, would have been very obvious. So that cannot be the explanation of our Mishnah that we're talking about yitoma, shnitar sev, nitgarsha. Ela hakamash malon, it must be, this is what the Mishnah is teaching us. Denara, shnitar sev, nitgarsha, ki yitoma. That a young girl, a ne'ara, who gets halakhically engaged and divorced, has the same din as a yitoma. Ma yitoma le'atzma, just like a yitoma, the kenas belongs to her, and it's her own decision. Af ne'ara, shnitar sev, nitgarsha le'atzma. So too, like Rabbi Akiva of the Mishnah before, when it comes to a ne'ara, that is, nitares and nitgaresh, then the kenas belongs to her, and therefore it'll have an afkamina between ones and mifateh. By the case of ones, where it's against her will, she'll collect the kenas. In the case of Mifateh, where she acquiesced, then she can't go afterwards and claim the Knas because she was the one who was mochel on her Biyah in that case. Now, there are questions that you could ask over here. Why didn't Rabbi Elazar just say it straight out? Halacha ki Rabbi Akiva. That would have been an easier way to teach us or easier way to express what he's saying. The answer might be because Rabbi Akiva, it's not clear what Rabbi Akiva holds. We have Rabbi Akiva of the Mishnah and Rabbi Akiva of the Braita. So Rabbi Elazar wanted to make it clear that it's talking about Rabbi Elazar of the Mishnah and Rabbi Elazar of the Braita, and therefore he expressed it in this way. In addition, it could be that Rabbi Elazar over here is adding on another dimension, which is that Rabbi Akiva only spoke about Kenas. It's possible that over here Rabbi Elazar is saying the Mechila does not only apply to Kenas, but also applies to Boshet Begam. And therefore Rabbi Elazar can't just say Aloha Rabbi Akiva, because Rabbi Akiva only mentioned Kenas. Rabbi Elazar's addition over here is that this is applicable across the board, whether it has to do with Kenas, or Boshet to Begam. In this instance, if it belongs to the woman, she can be mochel on all of these items, and not just the kenas. And in the other case, by Me'anes, where she is not mochel, then she will collect it. And that's the addition of Rabbi Elazar over here. But that does raise the question in general, is how is she able to be mochel on items that she does not have in her possession? With regards to Boshet to Begam, we could understand why maybe she could be mochel, because those are things in her control. Kenas is something that is a fine that is imposed by Beit Din. How could she be mochel on something in the future when she doesn't have the right to collect it yet until after the act is perpetrated? So, Bishonim, like the Ritva, suggests over here that it has to do with the fact that she has control over her body. And what generates the knas is her goof. And since the goof is here now, she's able to be mochel on her goof, which will then result in the lack of payment of the knas. And that's how he gets around the problem of her being mochel or forgiving something that has yet to become an obligation. And that's what compels some others to say that we're speaking about the boshet and the begam over here and not just the knas, because there she does have the ability to forgive, and it makes more sense that we're speaking about the forgiveness or the lack of need of payment by boshet begam, and then because of the hekesh between them, that might influence the knas as well. Rabbi Zeira, Amar Rabbi Bar Shila, Amar Rabbi Hamnuna Saba, Amar Rabbi Ada Bar Ava, Amar Rav. Halacha ki Rabbi Elazar. The halacha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua. Kari Rav Alei de Rabbi Elazar tuvina de chakimei. Rav calls Rabbi Elazar the best of the chachamim. Now, Rashi says tuvina de chakimei is ushar shebechachamim. Whether it means the best, the luckiest of the chachamim, from the word ashrei. And therefore Rav is giving the reason why, in a sense, we paskin like Rabbi Elazar over here, because Rabbi Elazar has, in Rav's eyes, this elevated status. And that elevated status is what compels us to paskin like him in many places. Question of which is which, meaning that because we paskin like him in so many places, that's why Rav says this about Rabbi Elazar. Or is it the other way around? Because Rabbi Elazar has this status in the eyes of Rav, therefore we paskin like him in many locations. It's not clear here from that statement of Rav which precipitated which. The next Mishnah says, Ezehu boshet. What is the boshet that is paid in these instances? Hakol lefi amivayesh vamitbayesh. Everything has to do with the nature of the person who caused the busha, as well as the victim of the embarrassment. Rashi over here says, Adam benuni amivayesh boshto kasheh. A regular layperson who causes busha, he is the worst or the harshest type of embarrassment that can be caused. Versus Adam Zolel, Umi Adam Chashuv. Versus a person who is a lowlife, and a person who is very high up or important. Both of those have less busha associated them with than with a regular lay person. So Rashi makes an assumption here with regards to the busha, that an Ish Benoni would generate the worst of busha for this incident or this infraction. The Ran over here says that that's not the case, and is a clear hierarchy, that the busha increases the lower the individual is on the totem pole, meaning that the higher the woman is on the totem pole, the more busha that is created for her. And the verse is true by the man. The higher he is on the totem pole, the less busha for the woman, and the lower, or the lower life that he is, then the more busha created for the woman. And it's not this Adam Benoni, where he has the highest and everything else is below that. The Ran says there's a hierarchy. The most chashuv creates the least busha, and the lowest, the Zolel, the person at the bottom of the rung, creates the most busha, and therefore there is this hierarchy, not like Rashi suggests that it's a bell curve where the Adam Benoni creates the greatest busha. But, of course, every situation is unique, and it has to be taken into consideration. Who are the parties? What is the culture? What is the nature of the infraction? All of these have to be taken into consideration in assessing the value of the busha that was created over here. Pigam. How do we assess the pigam, the diminution in value to the woman? We look at her as if she is a shivcha that is being sold in the shuk as a maidservant. How much was she worth prior to this problem, meaning when she was a betula? And now that after, how much is she worth? That's the diminution in value, and that'll be the pigam that is created over here. We'll have more discussion about that in the Gemara and get into more detail about that. Kenas shaveh b'chol adam. When it comes to kenas, that's equal across the board. Everybody pays the same amount. Chol sheyesh lo kitzvah min haTorah shaveh b'chol adam. Anytime the Torah gives you a fixed payment, then it's equal for everybody. There's no differentiation between parties because the Torah gives you a fixed amount. And that's the case here, where it says 50 shekel kesef, that applies to anyone and any place and any woman. That the knas is a fixed amount, and that's why it's considered to be a fine and not any restitution or reparations for anything that happened. The Gemara says, Ve'ema chamishim slaim amarach, mana mikol mile. Why don't we just say the Torah penalizes the individual in this case with a payment of 50 shekel kesef? Why doesn't that cover everything that is here? Why are you saying now that there are additional payments that have to be made, like boshin and pigam? Why don't we say that kanas covers everything? That's what the Torah gave. The Torah gave one number to cover everything. Amar Rabbi Zeiro yomru baal bat milachim chamishim, baal bat hejotot chamishim. How could it be that here, if he rapes a princess, he pays 50? And here, where he rapes a lay person, that he pays 50? How could it be that there's no differentiation between them? Amrle Abaye. Abaye says back to him, Ihochi gabi eved nami. By an eved kanani, where a shor who kills an eved kanani, you only pay 30 shekel kesef. It's a fixed kanas that is paid. You say the same thing. Yomru, eved nokev margaliot shloshim. An eved who has the capacity to cut diamonds, which is a very, very lucrative profession and helps out his master, and he only gets 30 shekel when he's killed. Eved osem aseh machat. And an Eved who's a tailor also only gets shloshim. Here you have a huge differentiation in their capabilities, and yet the Torah still gives a fixed price to them. There is no differentiation over there. Alama Rabbi Zera. So Rabbi Zera rephrases it and says, Ilu bau alel shnaim, echad kedarka v'echad shlo kedarka, yomru bau shleima chamishim, bau piguma chamishim. So in an instance where two people violated her, one did it kidarka in the normal fashion, and one did it shalo kidarka, they're going to say the one who had bia with a shlema, a woman who had yet to be defiled by a man, you pay 50. And then the second one who already now rapes this woman after she's already been defiled, it should be the same payment, meaning that there's no diminished busha at this point in time or diminished diminution in value to this woman because she's already been violated. Isn't there a change in the status of this woman? And therefore, there should be a differentiation in the payment. And that doesn't work over here. Amar Abaye, but he says back to him again. Yochi gabi eved, nami yomru. Eved bari shloshim. A healthy eved, only 30 shekel. Eved mukashchin. An eved that is sickly, kachush, weak, and he has boils and blisters on him. Also shloshim. So that can't be the solution. And then we're going to come up with the solution that Abaye and Rava give from the psukim. So Rabbi Zeira over here makes two statements. One statement is that, how could you not differentiate between a princess and a lay person? And then he makes another differentiation, which is, how could you not differentiate between a woman who's already been violated to a woman who is shlema, who has not yet been violated? Shouldn't there be a difference? Now, the question of what Rabbi Zera changed in his rephrasing of the distinction that he's trying to draw over here, some suggest that one of them he's talking about boshet, and one of them he's talking about pigam. That when he's talking about the princess versus the layperson, he's talking about the boshet over there. When he's saying about Shlema versus a violated woman, that's the issue of Pagam. So one time he phrased it with regards to Boshet logically, and then he phrased it also by Pagam logically, showing why there should be payment for both of these. The Shita Mukabetz over here otherwise says that in Rabbi Zeir's distinction between a woman who is a princess and a layperson, we don't find that type of distinction in the Torah. Torah does not differentiate it by the type of woman. And actually one of the innovations of the Torah vis-a-vis Hammurabi's code is actually there isn't, that all women and all people are looked at equally, and there is no such differentiation or scaling of the payments and the type of punishment that's given. Every Jew is a Jew, and no matter who it is, the Torah gives the law, and that's it. Those are the rules, and those are the payments that are made. On the other hand, we do find a distinction between Bitulah and Bi'ulah in the Torah, and therefore the second statement of Rabbi Zeir that relates to that actually has more precedence, and that's why he rephrases the statement in that way. In addition to it, the second statement of Rabbi Zeir makes an assumption, which is that if an individual engages with a Bitulah Shelo Kedarkah, he has violated her, and he is Chayav Kenas. So that is actually a machloket rishonim, which is whether there is a chiyuv kenas by the case of boel shelo kedarkah. Both from the Rambam and from Rashi, it seemingly over here we're talking about not the same woman, but two different women that are being contrasted, which is a woman who already had biyah shelo kedarkah versus a woman who never had any biyah at all. The boshet that's associated with the woman who already was violated shelo kedarkah is less than a woman who has never been involved in biyah at all. And what Rashi says is that, how could it be that you're equating these two women? Because biyah shelo kedarkah does not result in knas, it just results in a woman who's an isha p'guma. So then if you're dealing with an isha p'guma versus an isha shlema, the boshet should be different, and that's the claim of Rabbi Zeir. On the other hand, if you look at Tosafot says that definitely shelo kedarkah pays knas. And the situation over here is by a single woman. If a man violates a woman shelo kedarkah, he's chayav knas. And then the next individual comes and violates her kedarkah, he'll also be chayav kenas. And they both are chayav kenas, both the one who came on her shelo kedarkah, as well as the one that came kedarkah. But then Rabbi Zeir says, you're not going to differentiate? The one who came first shelo kedarkah was the first to violate her. Isn't that different than the next one who came and did it kedarkah? She was already a guma. She wasn't a shlema anymore. Shouldn't there be a distinction over there? Then, for that reason, Tosafot makes two comments. One is that the order of the Gemara is actually slightly out of order, and Rabbi Zeir's statement should be Ilu Baalea Shelo Kedarkah Vacharka Kedarkah. That should be the ordering, and Tosafot shows other places in Shas where the Gemara is not makpid on the order. But clearly the order then, according to the way Tosafot is explaining, should be first Shelo Kedarkah and then Kedarkah. Tosafot also adds is that it could be two people that were Baalea Shelo Kedarkah. The first one who violated Shelo Kedarkah and the second one who violated Shelo Kedarkah, you could ask the same question. And Tosafot says, Eino Hanami, you could have asked the question that way. Just the Gemara asked the question this way, which is, you can have two people be Chayav Kenas, but despite the fact that their actions are different. One action is he's violating a woman for the first time, and the other case he's violating a woman who's already violated. Clearly there should be some distinction over here, and that's Rabbi Zeira's logic. Now in each case, the Abaye rejects the logic by showing that there's precedence in other places where we do not make such a distinction. By Evid, we do not make that distinction, whereas Rabbi Zeir is trying to make this distinction by the woman. And therefore, Ela Amar Abaye, Abaye says that's not the source for the fact that she also pays Boshet Begam, but rather Amakra, Tachat Asherina. He pays the Knas because he afflicted her. Hani Tachat Asherina. This is the payment for the affliction for the rape. Michlal De'ika Boshet Begam. That comes to teach you that there's something else. There are other payments that have nothing to do with the affliction itself, dealing with the rape itself, that have to do with things that surround the rape, and that's Boshet Begam. Rav Amar Kura, Rav says we learn it out from here, V'natan ha'ish ha'shochev ima la'viyah na'ara, 50 kesef. There, ha'shochev ima is extraneous. It could just say, V'natan ha'ish la'viyah na'ara. Why does it have to say ha'shochev ima? That it teaches you that that 50 kesef is hanat shchiva. Hanat shchiva, nun. The hanah for the shchiva, for the rape itself, is nun. Mechalal diga Boshet Begam. Inferring from that, or implied from that, is that there are other payments for the Boshet Begam. This is only associated with the Hanat Shechiva. We already saw these limudim from Abaye and Rava earlier back in Lamed Gimel with Aleph. Over there we saw that Rava learns it from this pasuk because he holds like Ula. And since he holds like Ula, he needs Abaye's Tachat Asherina for the Gzeirah Shava. And because of that, he can't learn the same way that Abaye does, and therefore he's compelled to find a different pasuk to teach us that same limud. And let us say all these payments belong to the girl herself. That there is a gzeirat hakatuv when it comes to a ne'ara, that all shevach, any monetary gain that is created through a nara belongs to her father. How do we know that the output of a girl belongs to her father? Shnemar, v'chim gorish et bitole ama. Ma ama maseya del rabba, avbat maseya del avia. Since the father has the right to sell his daughter to another party, and that right to sell his daughter to another party, basically what he's doing is selling her future output to the master, and her output will be to the master. That means in the interim, that future stream of value belongs to the father. He can either keep it for himself or sell it to the other party. So avbat maseya del avia. So that means that it belongs to the father. Salam ali. Why do I need that? Tipuk lemi nura beit avia. How come I can't learn that out of Nura Beit Aviyah, that all the Shevach of the Nara belongs to the father? Elihoi b'afarat nidarim hu dichtiv. That posuk of Nura Beit Aviyah is written about the ability to nullify nidarim. So that we learn out in the context of nidarim that the value or the ability to nullify belongs to the father in those instances. V'chitem anelef minei. And you're going to say, okay, let's extrapolate from that to our cases over here, or the cases of normal monetary cases. Mamona misura lo yofinan. We can't extrapolate from Isser, which is a farat nidarim, over here to mamon, cases of regular mamon. V'chite elima nelef miknasa. Here you're going to say, well, why don't we learn it out of the case over here, where we see that it belongs to the father as well, by the case of knas, because it says, v'natan la'via ne'ara, that you give it to the father of the ne'ara. So why don't we learn out from there? Mamona miknasa lo yofinan. You can't extrapolate from knas to mamon. Not because knas is different than mamon, but simply knas is a chiddush. And since knas is a chiddush, how can you learn something from knas and then extrapolate that to mamon? Elamistavra davia havel. So then it makes sense that it's her father's. Di bai masuval minuval mukashchin. Because he has the right to give this girl over to marriage to someone who is a lowlife or disgusting, or mukashchin, someone who is covered in blisters and unsightly and unbecoming, and he's able to cause her both the boshet, the pigam, and possibly the tsar in marrying her off to this individual. Since he has that right, he also has the right of collection with regards to that. So now we have three different limudim over here. We have one limud with regards to the knas. The knas itself belongs to the father because it says in the pasuk, v'natan la'avia ne'ara, that you give it to the father of the ne'ara. We know that by nidarim, the father has the right to nullify the young girl's nidarim, even when she's a nara, even when she's a ketana, he has the right to do that because it says, shevach binura beit avia. They call shevach nura avia. That all of the benefits of her nirut belong to the father, and therefore he has the right to nullify nidarim. Now that gives us two pieces of information. Knas belongs to the father, and so does the right of nullification by nidarim. Both of those will not help us over here with regards to boshet begam, that it belongs to the father, because we can't extrapolate from either. By the case of nidarim, it's isur. By the case of ne'ara, by me'anes and mefatez, knas. So neither of those are going to help us to understand what happens to the boshet begam. The answer to that, the Gemara says, is that from the fact that the father has the right to marry this girl off, we learn out that boshet and begam belong to him, because since he has the right to create that circumstance or situation for the girl, therefore, when there are payments for that, he is entitled to those payments. And the fact that he's entitled to her production or anything that she does in her youth, that comes from the limud that Rabbi Huna Merab brings us, that the Masa Yadayim of the girl belong to the father, because just like he can sell forward to another party those Masa Yadayim, that means that he has entitlement to those Masa Yadayim. If he can sell them forward, then when he doesn't sell them, they belong to him. Pagam, Rohim Ataki Ilihi Shivcha Nimkeret. Hecha Shaminenla. How do we assess this pigam? Amar Avuah Deshmol, Omdim, Kam Adam Rotze Liten Ben Shivcha Betula, L'Shivcha Beula, L'Shamasho. So he says, you find out how much a person would like to pay to have a maidservant that's a Betula service him, versus a one that is a Beula service him. So Gemara asks the very obvious question, Shivcha Beula, L'Shamasho, Mayon Avgalei Mina. Why does he care about the status of the woman if the woman is simply servicing him? It's obviously there's no Bia involved over here. She's a shivcha knanit. She's a surah. So the only thing she's doing is servicing him. Why does it matter to him if she's a bitula or biula? Ela ben shivcha biula le shivcha she'ena biula la siya la avdo. So here it's a question whether when he buys the shivcha knanit for his eved to marry, whether the difference he would pay in price in order to get a biula versus a bitula. Where it says, la avdo may nafka lemina. Why does it matter to him with his eved? As far as he's concerned, the only thing their interest he has here is in the children that are born from their wedlock because they will be servants to him. And that's all he cares about. He doesn't care about whether the woman's a bula or bitula. He just cares that they reproduce together. Where it says, Ve'eved shishlo rabo korat ruach imenu. It's a case where this Eved has a special place in the master's heart, and he wants to do something to make his Eved happy. And therefore, in making his Eved happy, he feels a certain personal investment, and he's willing to pay a little more to get a bitula, which would be nice for his Eved, versus getting a bitula, which seems to be a small differential in money. So the Tosfot already asks over here, Tema, ma shuma hizu? What type of assessment is this? V'chi isha choshuva mishpacha gedola ane nifsede bivgama? El shaveh shivcha? Ani seid le'eved? How can you compare to a woman of high standing from a family that's miuchas to a shivcha over here? How does this equate in terms of the assessment? So Tosfot says, v'yesh lomar duchol isha shamin lefi mashi binyan zeh. Then ain't ochanami. Here shivcha is just an example because there is already market for these things. But it'd be true, we have to look at any individual or any woman in these situations, how much would someone would be willing to invest in the difference between a woman who's a bi'ula or bitula, and we have to look at the standing of the woman. It's not that the shifcha is the standard for everybody, but rather that's the standard for a shifcha. For other women, you'd have to adjust that pricing based on their chashivut. There are others that say that's not the case, that pegam is only trying to assess exactly what's said here, the difference between a shifcha bi'ula and a shifcha bitula. The differential that you're talking about, Tosafot, is already captured in boshet. Boshet is subjective, and Boshet will capture that differential that is not captured in the Pagam, because we assess everybody the same way with the Pagam. So that's a machloket as to whether Pagam simply covers what a Shifcha would be worth as a Bitula and Bi'ula, the remainder gets captured by Boshet, or Shifcha is just an example, and if the Pagam was with someone who was of a higher stature, then we would assess it differently than that of a Shifcha. Chol makom sheish mecher ein knas. Chol makom sheish knas ein mecher. In any place that the girl can be sold by the father, then there is no kenas for me'anes and mifateh. Chol makom sheish kenas, any place that there will be a collection of kenas for the rape or the seduction, ein mecher, then the father doesn't have a right to sell it. So now here the Mishnah explicates, tana yesh la mecher. When it comes to a ktana, a father has a right to sell his daughter as an amar vriya while she is a ktana. Ve'en la knas. He has no right to collect knas because by ones and mifate it says ne'ara. Ne'ara, yesh la knas. So now that a ne'ara from 12 and 12 and a half is entitled to a knas that is mentioned by ones and mifate, ve'en la mecher. But there is no ability to sell, meaning the father no longer has the right to sell his daughter. That's learned out of a kal v'chomer, which is that if he sold his daughter when she was a ktana as an amay vriya, she goes free when she becomes a ne'ara. So if she goes free, if she was already sold, then kal v'chomer that he can't sell her when she's already a ne'ara. A bogeret ein la lo mecher velo knas. A bogeret is not entitled to knas because she's not a ne'ara, and not mecher because the father obviously doesn't have any rights to sell a bogeret. So Amar Rav Yehuda Marav, zo divrei Rabbi Meir. This Mishnah is according to the Shita of Rabbi Meir, and we discussed this more extensively earlier on, that this Stam Mishnah is a libo de Rabbi Meir over here, because Rabbi Meir believes that a ktana is not entitled to knas. That ne'ara in the pasuk is literally ne'ara, and the only time there's a knas is from 12 to 12 and a half. The chachamim disagree, the chachamim omrim, yesh la knas b'makom mecher, that there is knas in the place of mecher. D'tanya, we have a brayta, ktana b'yom echad ashetavi shtei sarot, ktana from the day she's born until she reaches puberty, yesh la mecher, the father can sell her as an amai b'riah anytime during that period. Ve'en la knas, and she has no knas. Mishetavi shtei sarot, once she reaches the age of puberty, ashetivager, until the time that she matures, meaning from 12 to 12 and a half, yesh la knas, vein la mecher. There is knas then, because she's a ne'ara, but he can no longer sell her because she's over the age where their father's entitled to sell her as an amei vriya, divrei Rabbi Meir. Shaya Rabbi Meir omer, kol makom sheyesh mecher ein knas. Any place you can sell, there is no knas. Kol makom sheyesh knas ein mecher. Any place there is knas, then there isn't mecher. It's basically a simono for Rabbi Meir to teach you that the two are mutually exclusive because they deal with different ages. Knas is only shayach by a ne'ara, and mecher is only shayach by a ktana. V'chomim armim ktana mibad gimel shamim v'yom echad v'achiti v'ager. A ktana from 3 years and one day until she reaches bagrut yesh la knas. Now the reason that they start from 3 years is because of the issue of biyah. Biyah is only relevant from a girl, for a girl's standpoint, from 3 years and one day above. So from that point, meaning ktana and ne'ara, there is a knas. So when it says knas in mecher lo, there is knas but no mecher. Ema af knas b'mokom mecher. They say no, there's also knas in the place of mecher. Now truthfully, the mecher can start from day one. He can sell her as an amar v'ira from day one until she reaches the age of puberty. But what the Chachamim are focused on is in the Knas side of this, where they disagree with Rabbi Meir, and so therefore they started from 3 years in one day. So from 3 years in one day up. Or a Ketana, basically Knas is relevant from 3 years in one day up until she clears being a Nehara, until she reaches Bagrut. So that means from 3 years in one day until 12 and a half, there is Knas. As regards to Mecher, from day one until she reaches puberty, she is Mecher. And therefore there's an overlap. Why she's a Ketana between Mecher and Knas, according to the Chachamim. They agree that once she's a Nara, there's still Knas and no Mecher, because over there she's already graduated out of the stage in which her father can sell her as an Amai Vriya. Amar Rav Chista Maitaimo de Rabbi Meir. What is the reasoning behind Rabbi Meir Shita? Amar Kra, Velo Tiel Isha. Bim Hava Tzma Katuv Medaber. Lo Tiel Isha is in a case where she can have the ability to accept a Kinyan and bring herself into marriage. So that's only true of a Nara, of a girl who's of age. It's not true of a Ketana. And therefore, if lo tiyel isha only applies to a nara, so too, the psukim about knas by ones mifater only talking about a case where it's a nara. Rabbanan, Amar Eish Lakash Amar Kral, the pasuk says, nara afilu ktana b'mashma. When the word nara has subsumed in it, also ktana. Nara is not exclusively a nara. Nara is a terminology that covers also ktana. Shamar apapa b'reid rav chanan b'bei klochit. Azal Amra Bikamei the Rav Shimi Barashi. So he heard this memra, and then he told it over to Rav Shimi Barashi. I'm like, Atun Ahamat Nidula. You learned that memra of Reish Lakish on that Mishnah. Anan Ahamat Nidula. We learned it on this. Amra Reish Lakish, Shemotzi Shemra Lektana Patur. Person who makes a claim that Lo Matzati Bitulim about a girl who's a Ktana that he married and is found out to be lying in that case, he's Patur Minaknas. Shinemar Minatnula Vihane Ara. That you give it to the father of the Ne'ara. Ne'ara Malei Diber HaKatuv. The Pasuk by Motzi Shemra has Ne'ara written, Nun Ayin Reish Hei, Malei, full. So the limud here is that in cases where it says Ne'ara with a Hei at the end, Ne'ara means literally a Ne'ara and not anything else. Everywhere else in the Torah, Ne'ara is written Nun Ayin Reish Chaser. Even though we pronounce it as Ne'ara, it's spelled as Na'ar. And therefore, the term Na'ar is an all-encompassing term, which includes both Ne'ara and Ketana, because by Ketana, she's very similar to a Na'ar rather than a Ne'ara. And therefore, the term Na'ar, when it's written Chaser, even though it's read as Ne'ara, means both Ne'ara and Ketana. In a case where it's written Malay, and that one case, according to this, is only by Motzi Shemra, that Ne'ara is written Malay, there it means Ne'ara exclusively and not a Ketana. And so therefore, what we learn from that is that the word na'ar that's used in place by ones and mifateh, which is written chaser, will mean both ne'ara and ketana. Now, it happens to be that even by Motzi Shemra, it's actually written twice. It's written once chaser and once malay. Answer is that by the case of chaser, there's a different limud that the Gemara has from it over there. It comes to be mirabeh, bi'a shelo kedarka versus bi'a kedarka, and therefore it doesn't have the standard meaning of including a ketana. And therefore, only by Motzi Shemra, we have this exclusivity that's talking about a Nara and a Nara alone. Whereas by other cases where it's written Nar, he comes to include as a Ketana as well. So, Matkiv L'Rader Baba, Taimu Dikhtav Rachman a Nara. It's only because it wrote Nara. Halo of Halchi Avamina Afilu Ketana. Had it not written the word Nara Malay by Motzi Shemra, I would have thought that Motzi Shemra also applies to Ketana. Vaktiv, and doesn't it say, V'yememet Hayadavar Azeh, if the claim that the husband is making that she had an extramarital affair while there was a rusin, which is subject to a death penalty, lo nimtzu bitulim nara, then they weren't bitulim to the nara because she had this extramarital affair, but tziat nara petach beit avios kolua. And then they're going to take her out and they're going to stone her to death. I mean, she's subject to a death penalty in that case. Ktana la baton shimi. And a ktana is not subject to punishment. So how could the puzzle be talking about a ktana anyway? Because if it's found to be true, then she gets a death penalty. That wouldn't apply by a ketana. So that would make it that these psukim are exclusively speaking about someone who is of age. And ketana would have been excluded even without the word nara. Elakan nara, how kom alkom shnemar nara, filu ketana b'mashma. Now what it's coming to teach you is over here it's a nara. How do we know that it's talking about a nara over here? It's because the psukim are talking about a baton shin. And a baton shin can only be relevant by nara. Now, we learn from that over here it's a Nara, and also since it's written in Malay over here, it's Nara. But then if it writes Nar in any other place, you will not extrapolate from here, not learn from here, because it's different than here. Nara means Nara literally, because of the context in Motzi Shemra, whereas Nar means Afilu Ktana B'mashma, and therefore, since it's written as Nar by Ones Mifateh, over there we will say that it includes a Ktana according to the Chachamim. Now, Tosfot says over here, then why don't we learn from that that Motzi Shemra applies both to a Ktana and a Nara, and just say that whoever's a Bat Onshim will be punished, whoever's not a Bat Onshim won't be punished. It shouldn't change the Din of Motzi Shemra just because she can't be punished. It should just be that this Din has application in both cases. It's just in the case where she's a Ktana, she won't be held culpable for her activities. So Tosfot in the end answers that's because the Knas that he pays for Motzi Shemra is because he's attempting to cause her the death penalty, and there's a correlation between the knas that he's paying and the damage that he's trying to cause to this woman. And therefore, since there's a correlation between these two, she's not a Bat Onshin, he wouldn't pay the knas because he wouldn't have subjected her to death penalty. So only when she subjects her to the death penalty is he then held accountable for the knas, and that's why the Gemara concludes over here that it's a Nara exclusively and not a Ne'ara and the Kitana. Okay, we're going to stop over here at the end of Mem Amud Bet.